Welcome to the Trombone Retreat, a podcast of the Third Coast Trombone Retreat. Today on the podcast, two-time Grammy-nominated trombonist and composer Marshall Jilks joins us. My name is Sebastian Vera, at js.vera on Instagram, and I'm joined as always by bass trombone 444, Nick Schwartz. Nick, as a member of the New York City Ballet, is flexibility something you were just born with, or did you have to work for it?
Well, Sebastian, I'll tell you. When you got long, glorious dancer's legs like myself, it's a gift. It's a curse and a gift, I'd have to say.
Yeah, I don't see how they make any money keeping you down in that pit.
Well, that's for another episode.
You gotta keep your prize stallion in the front stable, you know what I mean?
Yeah, well, I mean, some could argue that the principal bass trombone chair is the prize chair.
Check and mate.
As the 444th best bass trombonist on Instagram, I approve of this message. Sebastian, how are you doing? How are you doing today?
Oh, you know, I wake up, put my sweatpants on one leg at a time, and Google Zoom backgrounds. Got some good ones, though. We had a nice talk with Marshall Jilks. I have to say, this was the first interview we've done where you know him a little bit, not as well as our previous guest. I have never met him, and I really enjoyed it. I found him very interesting and engaging and very humble for, you know, anyone that's heard him play and heard the incredible work he's done.
Yeah, Marshall and I went to school together, which we talked about in this episode. But it was funny. He came in. I didn't know his whole story, actually, even when we were in school. It was just kind of when he came in, it was like, oh, there's, because I actually got there before him, even though he's older than me. It was like, oh, there's this new guy coming in who's like already professional and he's awesome. That was kind of the whole thing. And so he got to school, and even when he was there, he wasn't around the halls that much, let's say, because he was off doing stuff. He was off working. He was off being busy. So I didn't know his whole story and how he got from Colorado to Juilliard, and I didn't know how many stops were along the way. So it was cool to kind of fill in the dots there. But I've known Marshall now, I guess, for about 15 years, and he's been amazing ever since I've known him.
We really appreciate all the 5-star reviews you've left. Keep them coming. We really appreciate it. And we'll answer one of the questions we received after the interview today. Some other news that we wanted to talk about was, we forgot to mention last time, we had to, like many festivals, cancel our Third Coast Trombone Retreat that we always have every summer.
The seventh annual,
wow. So we had to cancel it for obvious reasons with the pandemic. It was kind of a no-brainer. We had to do it. But we have some very good news. We've decided that we are going to do an online version. And we just kind of teasing it right now, but we're going to be including all the original guest artists and faculty and guest speakers. And it's going to be a really cool week. We will announce these dates soon. So stay tuned for that.
Yeah. I mean, with every bit of sadness, there's light at the end of the tunnel.
You know, that's true. That's true. One of my favorite moments in this podcast is when it's a few minutes in, you got to listen for it. It's when Marshall's like, okay, I'm feeling pretty comfortable now. And you hear him just like crack open a beer.
It was a cider, to be fair, but yeah.
Oh, it was a cider. Yeah. And I think you might hear that sound a few times if you listen. But yeah, we had a really awesome hang, and I hope you enjoy it.
Enjoy.
Yeah, it's going, man.
Did you get the kids to bed?
No, my wife's doing it, so. That's why I chose 8 o'clock. No, I'm just kidding.
Where were you supposed to be right now? Where were you supposed to be in the world?
What's today's date?
Who knows?
No one knows.
Today's Tuesday.
I think it's May.
Yeah, right.
May 13th, 12th, something like that.
I'm supposed to go to Battle Creek, Michigan tomorrow, I think.
Oh, nice.
Oh,
brass band.
Yeah, and then to Japan the week after for like 6 weeks.
Holy shit.
But that's all canceled. Yeah.
I'm in Michigan right now, about 2 hours from Battle Creek.
Oh, you are? Okay. What town are you in, Nick?
It's near Muskegon. I don't know if you know Michigan very well.
I know Muskegon, man. That's where Blue Lake Fine Arts Camp is near there.
Yeah, I have a cabin in the town where Blue Lake Fine Arts Camp is.
Wow, cool. And where do you live, Sebastian?
I'm in Pittsburgh.
Pittsburgh, okay. Cool, man.
Before we ask you, you know, what mouthpiece you play in your favorite alternate positions, I thought we'd get to know you a little bit better. You were a military kid, right?
Yeah, I am. I was. Still am? I don't know. No, I was. Yeah. My dad was in the Air Force.
Oh, mine too.
It was. Oh, cool. Man, what if we... How old are you, Sebastian?
I'm 37.
37? Oh, okay. So I'm 41 now. So who knows? Maybe we... Where were you stationed? You remember?
He was in Thailand during Vietnam, and he worked in crash rescue.
Okay, wow.
So I'm sure he had a million stories that he'll never tell me about, but...
Yeah, wow.
Pretty cool.
Wow, okay. Yeah, my dad was different line of work. He was a musician, so he was a... My dad was a trombone player, but he played euphonium in the ceremonial brass in Washington, D.C.
I've heard of euphoniums.
Yeah, yeah. Me too, yeah. So he went to Eastman School of Music and studied trombone with Emmy Remington.
Oh, wow.
In the 60s. So actually, I have his horn over here. I've been messing around with it lately. But
oh, cool.
Really? That's awesome.
My dad's horn, not Emmy Remington's, but
yeah. I guess it's, yeah.
Yeah. You know about long tones from like a very young age. Yeah.
Well, my dad didn't play any longer by the time I started playing. So he had become a conductor at that point and like an officer in the Air Force. So I was born in D.C. and he was stationed at Bowling Air Force Base where the Air Force Band is. But then we started moving around to the field bands. We lived in New Hampshire, New Jersey, Alabama, Illinois, then Air Force Academy. Wow. In Colorado. Yeah.
So was it just like a couple years in each place?
I'd say average was about four. Alabama was just 1 year. There's like kind of military college there you have officers go to. So we were there for 1 year only. It's like...
Where was that?
Montgomery, Alabama. Yeah. I was second grade there. So this is all still pre-trombone.
Okay. Were you always living on the base?
Not there. There we lived off base. And then in Colorado, we lived off base. Yeah. But just off the Air Force Academy. Yeah. So actually, my first high school was on the academy. It was a public high school, really? But it was actually on the Air Force Academy grounds. Yeah, it was called Air Academy High School. And
did they have music programs?
Yeah, they had a music program. Yeah, it was a regular public high school. So most of the kids were not military kids, actually. It just happened to be, you know, it was part of that school district, and the actual high school happened to be on the grounds of the Air Force Academy. So,
did you guys have shirtless volleyball games every day?
What?
It was a Top Gun reference.
Oh, sorry, that's Navy.
Come on, Marshall.
That's Navy.
Okay, all right.
Is that Navy? Right. Oh, that's, man.
Yeah, Top Gun's Navy, man.
Gotta rewatch this.
Oh, well.
Oh, right, because they take off the aircraft carriers on the water.
Yeah.
That is true. All right, well, you know.
They also flew.
Well, thanks for joining us.
They also flew F-14s, and the Air Force doesn't have any F-14s, so if you want to be super nerdy.
Well, that fell flat.
Yeah, sorry about
that. Something that you and Nick have in common. Nick, I don't know if you saw, but you guys both went to Interlochen and Juilliard.
You went to the academy?
I did. I went there my senior year of high school.
Me too.
Wow. Wow.
No kidding. Were you, who did you study with? Was it Rick Abono yet?
No, he came right after me. I was with Jeannie Little.
Yeah. I was towards the beginning of Rick Abono. I was maybe his third year there, something like that.
Okay, yeah. I think I was in there for Jeannie's last year.
Okay.
So that was your first experience to kind of get away from home and just be around a bunch of like-minded people of your own age?
I guess so. I mean, that was pretty life-changing for me, that school, because I came from Colorado Springs, where I had, you know, spent from eighth grade through junior high school. It was a pretty conservative place. Also, before that, I think I had decided that I was going to be a skier. That was going to be my career. Like, you know, I don't know if I had a real plan for that, but up until...
Skier and jazz musician. You're just about money.
Yeah, I guess that was kind of like my... Yeah. And trombone. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I always had this dream to like own a restaurant in Breckenridge that had like a jazz club in the basement. So I could ski all day, and then also I like to cook. So then cook and then play it, you know, at night or something. That would be like the optimal, the ideal situation.
Are days longer than 24 hours out there? I mean, that sounds like a lot to do in one day.
Well, no, you go ski the morning and then, you know, go cook in the afternoon. And I don't know.
That sounds like a nice little retirement plan.
Yeah. But then anyway, so I left there to go to Interlochen my senior year. I had been to the camp one summer. There was a chance that my family was maybe going to move for my senior year, so I didn't really want to start at another public high school. Couldn't really defend myself that well, so I didn't want to... No, I'm just kidding. But I ended up going to the academy. And actually, it's funny, though. I actually started my senior year at my public high school because we started much earlier than the academy. Because I wasn't really positive I was going to be able to go yet. So I started like the first week or two. And I remember it was funny because the music teacher at the school, he knew I despised marching band. And that was a big deal at the school, you know. He had already told me, like, you know, if you end up staying for the year, you know, I'm not going to make you be in marching band. You know, you can just use this time to go practice or something like that.
Oh, wow.
And so, so it was, you know, I remember that's how those couple of weeks were while I was still at the other school. But yeah, then I got the green light to be able to go, and it was kind of a last minute decision. But yeah, man, that changed my life though, just to be able to. It's kind of like going to a conservatory all of a sudden, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I do know.
Yeah, of course you know. Yeah.
Backing up slightly, being around your dad and being around that many professional musicians, that must have had a pretty cool impact, I imagine. Were you around jazz ensembles as well?
Yeah. So the I guess I would say I kind of started playing classical stuff. And then there was a jazz ensemble called the Falconers, which was part of the unit where my dad was the commander. So those guys also played in the concert band, but I would say they all were primarily jazz players. And so those were my first jazz teachers. Like there was a trumpet player there named Mark Israel. And then my first trombone teacher there was a guy named, I guess my first trombone teacher was my dad, but my dad was he was always pretty, pretty busy. So he would just kind of occasionally come in and, you know, I'd be like, no, you're playing the triplet. That's not a triplet. That's a dotted eighth note. That's not a triplet, you know, like, and that kind of thing. No. Do this again. Just like, you know, kind of, those are my favorite kinds of teachers that are really direct, you know? Yeah. So then I studied with a guy named John Gohl, who was in the Air Force Academy band there, a classical player. And then I started taking some lessons with one of the jazz trombone players there, a guy named Mark Burdett. He kind of got me started with like doodle tonguing and that kind of stuff. And yeah, so that was really cool. But I would go to all their concerts. I couldn't, you know, I was always super excited to go check them out. And so it's kind of funny, like my introduction to jazz playing was through big band stuff, you know, and mm-hmm. I kind of found my way more to small group playing via that. And then now in the last few years, kind of back more to big band stuff because I, you know, wrote my last couple records were big band things that I wrote, you know.
And you did I see right that you actually got to go back and perform with the Falconers?
Yeah, I just did. Oh, I guess that was last November. That was, yeah, it was kind of, yeah, crazy to look out and see, you know, to stand in front of the band and, you know, that's kind of how I got into music, you know, or how I got into jazz at least, you know. Yeah, they commissioned me to write a piece. They actually just sent me, they sent me some videos from that concert that they're going to release.
That's cool.
But yeah, it's some of the old guys that I used to go watch came to the gig, you know, and, you know, it's cool.
So leaving Interlochen, did you go straight to Juilliard from there?
No. So I had a pretty strange, well, unorthodox way through school, I guess you could say. So I went back to Colorado. I went to the University of Northern Colorado for a year. And I had a teacher there, a guy named Buddy Baker,
mm-hmm.
who's an excellent teacher, like for really fundamental teacher, you know. And there was no jazz major there either. So I was actually a classical major. You know, I knew it was a little bit of a tricky transition going from Interlochen, kind of a conservatory environment, to like back to a university, you know. I like that conservatory environment, you know, where it's just kind of all music and arts and everybody's doing something really creative, you know. And so anyway, I kind of knew pretty early on at the school, I was like, oh, I don't think this is really the right fit for me. But I had a really great trombone teacher, and there was a jazz program, so I was playing in the big band at the school and stuff. And then I had some really good theory classes and stuff. So what I did is I dropped all my academics. I took like 12 credits and I just hunkered down in a practice room every day, like, you know, hours. And what I would do is I would switch between a trombone for an hour and then maybe at the piano for an hour, or trombone for an hour and then work on transcription, then back to trombone. And that's kind of what I did. And then I transferred to the next year to the New York City area. I knew I wanted to be in that area. So I went to William Patterson University, which is, I was kind of well known for its jazz program. And Conrad Herwig was the teacher there at the time. So, and I was a big fan of his. So I went out to study with him. He had just started playing with Joe Henderson at the time. So he actually left after the first semester. And then Ed Neumeister came the second semester.
Oh, nice.
So, and then, yeah, it was like, but it was kind of interesting. It was a very small group driven school. So that was, you know, that was good for me to be around that. But then, you know, I still didn't feel like the right fit for me. I wasn't really positive what I wanted to do. So I left the school and I went and played on a cruise ship for the summer.
Wow.
And then I moved into Brooklyn.
hold on. What was that cruise experience like?
That one was fun. That was, where did we go? We started in Tampa each week and then went to, it was like 3 and 4 day cruises to like, let's see, Florida Keys, Key West we'd go to, and then to Cozumel and then to Grand Cayman.
Wait,
and
so it was only 3 or 4 days. So did that mean that like every time after the 4 days was done, would you have to like pack your bags, leave the ship and get onto another ship? Or could you leave?
No. I lived on the same ship for 3 months. So the passengers got off the cruise, stayed on.
So yeah. How long would the turnover be between cruises? I mean, like, so
with those cruises, you'd come in the morning, and the passengers would get off, I don't know, by have breakfast and leave the ship, and then the new passengers would come on in the afternoon, kind of like a hotel does it, you know, the checkouts at 11, you know.
It's amazing they can turn it over that fast. So many rooms. It's unbelievable.
Yeah. So I
guess that's how they make money, huh?
Yeah. But so I did that. And then I moved into Brooklyn, and it was funny back then. I think, you know, I always had this idea about New York, just thinking like, oh man, I'm not ready to play, you know? So I'm just going to move, you know, and just figure things out. So I moved into town and got a job as a waiter at a place called, it's called La Lanterna di Vittorio, which is a little cafe on McDougal Street in the West Village, right by Washington Square Park. Yeah, I waited tables there. The funny thing is, you know, I don't know, 10 years later, the owner made this room downstairs a bar where he had jazz trios. So I'd start playing there with my trio. And every time I would go back, he would always go, ah, Marshall, you've come to beg for your job back. You know, like, but I did that for a while. And then so I was about, I guess I was 20 years old then. And then maybe started getting called to do some little rehearsals here and there. I think the first professional thing I ever got called for was to go do a salsa rehearsal in Brooklyn. Yeah, that was like my first gig in New York City was in a salsa club. But then I got an opportunity to go on I got called to do another cruise ship. So I sub up my apartment, or I moved out, or I can't remember exactly what I did. But this cruise ship was, at the time, was the biggest one in the world. It's called the Grand Princess. Actually, it was recently in the news for not so good reasons. But
right,
yeah. Guys remember? Yeah. But I was like, hey, I know that. No. But yeah, it was at that time, it was like a 4.5 month contract. And I got on the ship, let's see, in Fort Lauderdale, and then we crossed the Atlantic Ocean. We stopped at the Azores, and then we did, like, I guess it was 11-day cruises back and forth. We'd start in Barcelona, and then in Monte Carlo, we'd stop. And then the next day, we go to Livorno, Italy, and then through the Straits of Messina, which is between Sicily, you know, Sicily and the boot of Italy, and then up the Adriatic to Venice, and there we would stay overnight in Venice. And then the next day, leave a day at sea and then go to Athens. And then one more day at sea and then to Istanbul.
Wow.
In Istanbul, you'd be there for 2 nights because then all the passengers would get off. And I guess it took a little longer on that ship. And then we'd go back and go back to the same route backwards to Barcelona. And so new passengers would get on in either city. But anyway, I did that for like 4.5 months and I turned 21 on that ship. And
oh, boy.
Do they have alcohol on those ships?
I'd have to check that out. I'm not really sure. Yeah,
but you're playing like every single night, right? It's like
you're playing every night, but man, you're actually those nights when we were in Venice, we occasionally would have to play some like dance set in the afternoon, but we were pretty much free at night, you know. And so those days, we'd just go out and explore, you know, just get lost in the streets of Venice at night. It was awesome, man. You never have to pack a bag because you're, you know, on the ship, and there's very little responsibility playing trombone on
your old.
Yeah, it was pretty. Yeah, I'm glad I got to do it and got to see a lot of parts of the world.
Were there a lot of like gnarled old jaded musicians at all in your band?
A few, but actually, it's funny. Like a lot of the guys from that band. A handful of them I'm still in contact with, like friends, you know, I've seen here and there over the years, you know? Yeah. Like I just a couple weeks ago was texting with a couple of them, you know, we had a really good group of people, like friends on that. There was kind of, there was a lot of younger awesome. People in that band. There were a few of those guys, but those guys were cool too. You know what I mean? You know,
get out while you still can.
Yeah. Yeah. So
I've been on this ship for the last 20 years.
That's not a cha-cha-cha. No, it's kidding.
Yeah. That's not how we do it on the Princess.
Yeah. Haven't you ever heard of a foxtrot? No. But yeah, so I, you know, then after that, I moved back to Brooklyn. And I guess from there, I guess at that point, I did some temp work, you know, working, answering phones at like, you know, Wall Street. Kind of was like a temp service where I remember I spent a lot of time at Payne Weber, it was called. Answering the phone at the front desk, and these brokers would come out to me really mad because maybe I screwed up the transfer or something. You know? Like, but and then you know, I'd say I did that for a few months, and then kind of I started going up to my roommate, which was a guy I had gone to school. We were friends from Interlochen, and he was really into Latin music, Cuban music, and salsa, and We used to go down to this place called Gonzalez y Gonzalez, which is a little club downtown. It was actually a Mexican restaurant, but they would have salsa bands and sometimes Latin jazz stuff. So we would go down to see a guy named Ralph de Rosario's band, who's a really incredible timbale player. And he had a band called Timbalaye and another band called Son Criollo. I remember I kind of went up to one of the trumpet players, a guy named Pete Nader, and I just asked him because I wanted to learn more about the music to be involved, to know what I was doing if I was going to start playing more of it. And he said, oh, man, go up to this place called Boys Harbor Conservatory, which is up, I think it's on 104th and 5th Avenue in Spanish Harlem. He said, go there on Monday night at 6 o'clock, and they have a big band, you know. And so I went up on, I took my horn, and they're like, hey, we need a trombone, you know. I went the next Monday, and we need a trombone, you know, you want to play? And one of the singers, man, give me your number. And then like, hey, can you rehearse on Wednesday? It was like literally that fast. And next thing I knew, I was playing 6-7 nights a week playing in salsa clubs in New York.
Some of those hits start at like 2 a.m. or something, right?
Oh, yeah, man. There's three. I remember there was one band, this guy named Raulín Rosendo. He's a kind of a Dominican, he's a Dominican star, but he's kind of a star. He's kind of Dominican.
Kind of Dominican.
He's a star, you know, like, and these guys called me, hey, can you do this gig? I didn't know who he was. I was like, oh, yeah, sure. Yeah, we're going to meet the bus at 181st Street. And right by that bridge, I guess that's right by the Cross Bronx. Yeah. So meet us there at 7 p.m. We're driving to Rhode Island for a gig. You know, there's a bus, you know. And I remember those gigs, every time I show up, you start calculating. Okay, they said be here at 12. Okay, I'm going to get here at 1. We never left before like 2 or 3 hours. You know, they could never find the singer. I started working with that band and a bunch of other groups. And, you know, I'm really, really, you know, thankful now that I had that opportunity because it was a huge influence on my writing and playing. And I think development as a brass player too, you know, but also, you know, I think I can kind of trace back most of the gigs I do now. Well, not now, but you know, most of the gigs I do at this point in my career, I can kind of trace back to like the very first little salsa rehearsal I did in Brooklyn. You know, I remember I met a trombone player there named Chris Reinemann. Then he recommended me for some big band that met, I think the place was called Friends Seminary down by Union Square. And then I met Alan Ferber there, who had just moved to town. I think we went to Smalls, the old Smalls before. I mean, it's the same location, mm-hmm. but before they, you know, renovated it. And we went there to see Kurt Rosenwinkel's band and became friends. And then I know he recommended me to audition for a Broadway tour called Swing that I ended up getting and doing. So I did that. And I guess going forward, that was kind of the next thing I did was in 2001, 2002, this was a Broadway tour called Swing. And the band's on stage, and then the trombone player had this big feature, Cry Me a River, with a plunger with one of the singers. And she, like, actually, you know, I had to wear knee pads because you have to crawl around the stage playing with a plunger.
Really?
Like, saying, oh. I'm sorry. Yeah. Yeah, don't tell anybody. no, but, and then she, like, grabs you the horn, and, you know, it's supposed to be this whole, you know, it was like acting and playing, you know. It was fun. I mean, just that one tune, and then the rest of it was we were playing, on stage every night. But I did that for almost a year. I remember our opening night of that show was in Charlotte, North Carolina. It was canceled because our opening night was September 11th.
Oh my God!
Yeah, so I had left New York, I guess, the week before or 2 weeks before to start that tour because we rehearsed just outside of Washington D.C. And then we'd just gotten to Charlotte for the opening night, and then started this tour. Started after that, and kept on going. I did it for. I originally signed on for like 3 months and then stayed until the end and went to Japan and stuff with it. And then I came back to New York and just kind of got back in the trenches playing and doing everything from playing weddings and playing big bands, small group things. And then anyway, so I guess at some point I decided to go back and finish school. And that's when I went to Juilliard.
Why did you have that urge?
Well, I guess I think my girlfriend at the time encouraged me, said, oh, you might want to teach someday. So you're going to need this paperwork. So, but, actually, to be honest, that's never really been the case now, I don't think. But I'm really happy I did it. Like, I made so many friends there, but also I kind of got going back there. Also, I really got back into kind of like my classical beginning somewhat, I think, too. Even though I was in the jazz program, most of my lessons were. Or most of my classes were jazz classes, but also the classical classes. Like, did you ever have Mrs. Cox, Nick?
Oh, yeah. I had her like 2 or 3 years.
That's like one of my favorite teachers ever.
She was difficult, but very good teacher. You
like
learned
old,
a lot.
Old school, though. Like, that's like I was talking about, like my dad. Like, no, no, no. You know, I remember one time.
She taught ear training, right?
Yeah, ear training. Yeah, yeah.
But, very famous.
Yeah, yeah. Amazing. But I had quite a few classes with Kendall Briggs.
Uh-huh.
Sure. I really dug. And I even studied Italian at the school. I had this teacher, great teacher, Michael Maione. But then, you know, the jazz program was really great. A lot of great players in the school. And then they asked me to come back to be an artist diploma program. They were changing up at the time. And so I kind of said, okay, I'll do it, but I want to take all classical trombone lessons. So I split my lessons when I was in the artist diploma program with Alessi, trombone player. And
Hold on. First name, please.
What, first name?
Yeah.
That's an olive oil I've heard of.
and then this other teacher I was mentioning, Kendall Briggs. So yeah, it was just a really, I don't know, I dug it. And at the whole time I was there, I was still working, you know, I was still going, playing a Broadway show at night or going to play a wedding or, you know, I remember, you know, having to leave him. And I still lived in Brooklyn, which is, if you're going to go to the Juilliard School, you're probably not going to move to Brooklyn, but I was already there. So I commuted for 4 years from Brooklyn.
Kind of more common now. I think people are going to, I felt like when we were in school there, everyone lived kind of between, like, I don't know, 34th Street and 181st Street, kind of going up more than down.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But I've met more students that live like up in Inwood or in the Bronx or like in Brooklyn and so on.
Well, Inwood's cool, but Inwood's still pretty close to getting to Juilliard. But from where I was in Brooklyn, I'd have to jump on, I lived in Park Slope. So I'd have to get on the R train, then switch at Atlantic to the D, then switch to the one or walk from Columbus Circle. And I was always a time optimist, you know, thinking, I don't know if that's the right
word. A time optimist. I like
that. You know what?
I have a lot of students like that.
Best case scenario, it's going to take me 56 minutes to get to school. So for some reason, I never took the worst case. And I was always, I guess if I had, did you have Mueller? I guess you had Mueller's class, right? I tried to make sure I was on time for that one, man. But
he kicked me out of like three classes, I think.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I'm trying to remember. It might have been you or it might have been Mike D's. So I had a class with Mueller, and we were starting to listen to some example of Baroque music. And it was either you or Mike. And
it was Mike. Yeah.
Yeah. And he goes, I don't know. This doesn't sound too Baroque to me.
Oh, yeah.
And it's such a dumb joke. But oh, my God, he kicked his ass to the curb so fast.
Yeah, actually, I liked him, though. I learned a ton in that class because I wasn't quite the, well, I wasn't a lot of classical music, but not like some of these, you know, some of the kids at Juilliard, like, excuse me, Mr. Mueller, is it true that Beethoven used to stop and he would pick up a sandwich on his way home to write, and that sandwich, he liked mayonnaise, but they didn't have mayonnaise back then. And you know what I mean? Like the kids, totally. Like they just have, and totally. And he was like old school kind of teacher too, where he would hand the quizzes back, I think in the order of the scores of the, you know, I think the first quiz, I, you know, had 9 questions. And I missed like 4 because it was like, they were hard.
Oh, they're brutal.
Yeah. So he brings my first. I was like, oh, whoops. But then I remember this one quiz. He did a drop the needle test on all the movements of Pierrot Lunaire, Schoenberg, you know. And man, I put it on my iPad and I just all back and forth to Brooklyn every day for like a couple of weeks. I was just nonstop listening to, and I aced it. And he handed the test back kind of like, man, I don't know how you cheated on this. He kind of looked at me like, I don't know how you aced this, but.
You know, I remember there was a test and it was on organum and it said, name the composer and the years. And so, I mean, you know, from like the year 700 or something that, you know? And I said, it was like I can't remember who I said, but I said it was the year 900 and I got called into his office and he was like, how can you be off by 200 years? And I'm like, yeah, I kind of think it's saying like, not much really happened those 200 years. Like you kind of think did, but like it's pretty negligible to modern ears, you know.
You know, saving grace with him though was if you talk, he loved football. So if you ever talked about NFL with him, and he was the same way about sports history as he is with music history.
You remember what he would say about Notre Dame?
No, I forgot that.
He would say Notre Dame plays football. Notre Dame does organum.
Sorry.
I mean, you kind of touched on it a little bit and you said how you kind of grew up, you know, just learning the trombone and not really kind of putting yourself in a category. And we're going to get to your career now. but you studied with serious classical people, about as serious of classical people as you can study with, as well as you studied with Wycliffe as well.
Yeah, with Wycliffe. Yeah, also, I didn't mention that. Juilliard.
I mean, these are very different players.
Ed Neumeister.
Mm. Ed Neumeister. Yeah. As far as approaching the trombone, getting better on a day-to-day basis, did you ever see a difference as far as the way you developed your technique and sound, or were you just going for, I'm trying to be the best trombonist I can be to develop my voice to enable myself?
Yeah, I mean, I guess over the years, like I mentioned Buddy Baker, he started me, you know, was really adamant about all his students doing his daily routine every day. And so I've kind of been doing some version of that. I did it earlier today. I throughout this whole, you know, pandemic, I've actually, you know, I don't have to have my chops prepared for some, but it feels good. So I still go through my routine. But over the years, I kind of keep on adding and taking away new things that I've kind of found and you know, to try to challenge myself and constantly push the boundaries of stuff. But I guess, you know, I would say I have a very fundamental approach that I try to hit with the horn every day. And if I'm at home, like the last couple of days, I did my routine on my big horn, you know, depending on what gigs I have coming up, sometimes I'll do it on my small horn or sometimes I'll just alternate. But it's funny, like if I practice my general practicing now, I would do my routine and the next thing I would do is play some etudes each day. And, you know, I guess my go-to is usually like book two of the Bordoni stuff. And I
never heard of it.
Yeah. And if I'm, especially if I try, like if I have a trio recording or trio gig or something like that, like really taxing kind of jazz playing stuff, I find if I do those in tenor clef, because they're so long, do those in tenor clef where they're written and down an octave, that I feel like, man, it's like, it's almost like superstition these days at this point, you know, but really? I feel like I, you know, I need to do that just so I feel really strong, you know, when I go out to play that, you know, and then of course I'll work on tunes, you know, or, you know, improvisation and stuff. Or the tricky thing too now is trying to balance writing too, you know, like, because sometimes maybe I have a deadline to write a piece or something or a commission. But in terms of approaching the trombone, I guess I it's a bit of a pet peeve of mine. I don't like when people say, oh, that guy's a jazzer, or he's a, you know, like this kind of like, oh, you have to it's only possible to be one or the other, you know. That said, I would say I'm definitely more comfortable playing in the jazz setting, because I do it on a more regular basis and get called to do a lot more of it. But I love practicing classical repertoire, you know. You know, I guess I talk about this in a lot of in master classes a bit. Like sometimes I'll, you know, try to make classical players play tuba mirum in A flat or play it in A or G. And I guess my point is that, like, I think we could all learn from what, you know, from different genres. But I think classical players these days could actually be a lot more in touch with their instrument, meaning like the bridge from their ear to their instrument. You know, I think maybe because of the way things are designed now with auditions, and then you have to perfect an excerpt to go win an audition. But sometimes, you know, sometimes guys can, you know, they can paste Wagner to the back of the house, but they can't play Happy Birthday if you ask them by ear, you know, and that's kind of a weird disconnect. So I don't know. I talk about just trying to, I guess my idea is just to try to make music as much of a stream of consciousness when you play, or you're playing trombone, just whatever style. So improvising, sometimes if I'm playing a jazz thing and I go into a cadenza, I might go into some kind of classical kind of thing improvised, you know? Yeah. I don't know. I guess that's kind of where I'm at with that now. Sorry. That was kind of a,
yeah, no, yeah. That makes, well, that was great. I mean, I asked that, I mean, it was kind of a leading question, but because you do both styles so well, and I was kind of hinting at that, we view things as two categories so often, and it doesn't really seem, especially in New York City, I mean, to survive in New York City, I mean, I lived there 9 years. I mean, you have to be able to say yes to everything. You got to, the more things you can do, the more skills you have, the more styles you can play,
yeah,
the better.
Sure. I mean, and I don't think I really did it for learn, you know, kept on working on both things for survival. It just kind of just, I guess sound wise, I was always kind of driven to, I like really, you know, warm kind of, I guess somewhat coming out of the classical tradition sounds, you know, I love listening to that. So maybe spending a lot of time working on that stuff just to try to develop my own sound and just kind of continuing with it, you know? Yeah. I wish we had, yeah. I always wish there's more time in the day, because there's, you know, I never have as much. I always want to work and learn more stuff. And
two kids, right?
I do have two little kids right now. Yeah. That's, yeah.
That's going to take a lot of time.
That's good though. I mean, it's, you know, it's actually, you know, it's interesting, like this, during these times we're in now, and, you know, you know, as sad as it all is, at the same time, it's given me a chance to just kind of step back a little bit. And I hope we can find a solution to all these, find the end to this, but I feel super motivated right now. And it's funny, it's maybe given me a break to kind of step back, and I'm have all these ideas for writing ideas right now, and, you know, recording project things I want to do. And I just don't have the time in the day right now, you know?
I was going to ask you, just kind of non sequitur, who were some of your, I mean, we talked about who you studied with, who were some of your idols sound wise that, you know, that playing wise that you worked with, maybe you didn't work with, but you looked up to, like who kind of led you towards trombone sound, you know, what you find to be a great trombone sound and influenced you.
Yeah. Man, that's a
good, it doesn't have to be trombones either. Let me be sorry. Let me,
yeah. Well, that actually helps me. I'm glad you said that. I think this guy, Mark Burdett, I'm not sure if I mentioned him earlier, but he was the guy from the Falconeers there. It's actually funny. My dad just mentioned yesterday that he heard from him because he's actually retiring now after 30 years in the Air Force, you know. But I listened to him a lot. I really loved his sound. So I think that was part, maybe first influence from there, you know. Other people, well, it's interesting. Like somewhat my path in terms of like trying to really work on my sound. There was a teacher at Interlochen who he would come up from Oberlin to teach the guitar students. But one week I asked him if I could take a lesson with him, and he kind of played I guess you could say like Wes Montgomery kind of style guitar, like big strings, you know, and big hollow body guitar, and sound was like it was all about him. And but I remember he in the lesson he asked me, he said, "Man, what are the elements of music?" And I was like, I don't know. You know, like, and he was like melody, harmony, rhythm, and sound is what he said. And he's like, those first three things are amazing, but if you don't have the sound to back it up, he goes, it doesn't matter. And so just him saying that in the lesson, you know, it's funny. I told him later, because a couple of years ago, I went back to Interlochen as a guest, and he was a guest too, and we played together, and I told him about this, and he was like, "You took a lesson with me?" So I was like, he didn't remember it at all. But we actually became friends now, and text and stuff sometimes. But man, he said that to me, and I remember then that next year, my first year of college, when I was telling you at Northern Colorado when I was practicing so much, I remember just trying things like playing long tones with like the lights really dim and dark, and just trying to darken up my sound as much as possible, you know? So over the years, I also listened to a lot of saxophone players and trumpet players. And I think some like, you know, I liked a lot of different tenor, like modern tenor players, guys like Seamus Blake or Mark Turner. And I think they have like a very focused, like even sound throughout. And so I think I was listening to a lot of stuff like that. And I wanted to be able to improvise and keep an even sound throughout the trombone. So meaning like not just get up to a high note and hit it and like, okay, great, I got the high note, everybody clap, but make it more of like part of a moving line that I could get up and come back down and move around and not, you know what I mean? And so I think a lot of that, the desire to want to be able to do that kind of led me to, it, I guess, ended up influencing my sound somewhat, you know, just trying to stay like, if you listen to Mark Turner, he's just like, even up into the altissimo of the tenor and then all the way back down. But then I listen to trumpet players like Freddie Hubbard or Tom Harrell, I guess, a lot. And then obviously classical players, you know, like Joe. And I love Joe Sound. We just did this new Slide Monsters record. And I was listening back to that, and man, his sound is just amazing on it. It's like the first thing that pops out to me. I was like, wow, you know?
Yeah, he might have a future.
Yeah, you never know.
So what was that Slide Monsters? What has that experience been like? I mean, you've done a couple tours or you're supposed
to? No, we were about to do one in June, which is canceled. I get to think, try to reschedule it next year sometime. But yeah, man, it's just been awesome for me. It's kind of a dream for me because I love the idea of going out and playing jazz and classical on the same concert, you know, or you know what I mean? And
that's against the rules.
Yeah. And, yeah, I mean, that group, I mean, it's like, I mean, playing with guys like you know Brandt at all?
I don't know him, but I know of him.
Yeah. Just, you know, him and Joe and Ajero and the music, you know, Ajero wrote most of it on the first record. I wrote one piece and a couple other composers are on it too. But the most recent one, I wrote two pieces for it. And it's, you know, it's just, man, it's really challenging because most of the music is pretty difficult.
Yeah,
it's also just
crazy.
Super fun, though, just to walk out and play with trombone players of that caliber every night. You know, for me, I don't get to do the classical side of it as often as I would like. So, you know, I really, it's been an awesome experience. And also, like, the, you know, in Japan, like some of the concerts we did, just huge crowds coming out for trombone quartet. You know, it's
leave it to Japan, right? They always turn out for stuff, man.
Yeah, yeah.
So you spent some time in Germany. I'd love to hear about that experience.
Oh, yeah. So I was a member of the WDR big band, Westdeutscher Rundfunk is what that stands for, West German Radio. And basically, I'll give a little background. So in Germany, I think every state has its own kind of public broadcasting. So every state in Germany has its own NPR, basically. But it's super well-funded. It's super well-funded. Is that what I just said? Wow. It's very well-funded.
I heard everyone, I was talking to some German friends today, they said everyone pays into it.
Yeah, they have, it's called GEZ. It's what it's, you know, people don't like to call it a tax. It's a radio fee. I don't know why they don't want to call it a tax, because you're supposed to pay it by law. But yeah, I think it's, I don't know, when I was there, it was about 20 euros a month or something like that. But when you plug your TV in, you have like, I don't know, 100 channels already. So it's kind of, wow. But imagine 100 PBSs. No, I'm just kidding.
there's only so many documentaries they can do about Gettysburg, yeah. You know?
Yeah, yeah. Oh, Dr. Zhivago's on 100 channels right now. No, I guess this was when I was still finishing up at Juilliard, I think, when the first time I went over. So John Fedchuk sent me a message saying that he knew that they were looking for somebody. And so I thought, man, you know, like, why not send an application and see? You never know. I mean, so I sent, you know, I sent the materials in, and they said, oh man, we want you to come. The way they did auditions there is they invited me to come work with the band for 2 weeks, you know. So they flew me over, put me up, and paid me. And that was the first audition, round one, you know, and they did that for a year with different people. And then I got a message like a year later, you know, that they were inviting me back, you know, to come again. So the first time I went 2 weeks, second time I went for like 3.5 weeks. And then a couple months later, I remember I was walking, I think I was coming back from Thailand on a trip with a bass player, so named Richard Bona, a really great, I don't know if you know him, but great bassist and singer from Cameroon. And I think we were coming back from Thailand and, or maybe it was, I don't know, was that or South America somewhere, but we were
same difference.
My memory is usually hazy when I'm coming back from Thailand too.
And I remember getting a message, hey man, congratulations, we selected you to be join the band. I was like, oh, cause, you know, I mean, they had asked me like, if we offered you the job, would you want to do it? You know, and I was like, yeah, man, I like, you know, I thought it, you know, could be a really great experience. So yeah, I took the job. I moved to Germany. I guess I moved to Germany in January, maybe it was March or something of 2010. I mean, and I stayed for 4 years. And, you know, I guess I, at some point I kind of had decided that I wanted to try to kind of maybe pursue my own stuff as much as possible more. So I decided to come back, you know, so I left that and I came back basically, I guess, middle of December 2013 or something like that, yeah.
So you were there for, this is Cologne.
Cologne, yeah.
What was your impression of, I hate to say the word scene, but, you know, obviously this is one of the most famous big bands in the world. Were there other Americans in the group?
Yeah.
But were you surprised by the level of playing when you got there?
I mean, I knew of the band because of when I was a kid, my brother had a record, East Coast Blowout, which was with a great composer, Jim McNeely, and it featured John Scofield. I mean, I love that record. So I knew the band because of that. But then over the years, obviously a lot of other things. They've been part of the, you know, tons of great, they put out tons of great recordings and stuff. So, you know, the band, I mean, it's a really great group. There's multiple Americans. I'm thinking, when I was there, I guess the most, there were four of us at one, right before I left, there were four Americans in the band. There were three when I got there, and then Andy Hunter came in on third trombone.
Oh, okay.
Who was my roommate at Interlochen.
No kidding.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
That's funny.
So, yeah. And then, but now I think there's three again because trumpet player retired, but now a piano player joined who's American too. But the group was really multinational. I would say there were three Dutch musicians, two Austrians, two Swedish musicians, and then the rest were German.
Did you ever consider sticking around for a while? I mean, it seems like a pretty comfortable living for a jazz musician.
I mean, it is, you know. Yeah, I guess it's a hard decision to give up, full-time. They call it unbefristet Vertrag, which means, like lifetime contract. And in Germany, a contract's like it's a contract. It's not, like here you sign a contract. Yeah, but, we can cancel that, definitely I had to think about it a lot before giving that up. I don't know. I guess I just felt like, I wanted to have more opportunities to write and stuff for, I've gone back twice since I left the band. So once was immediately after, like a month later, I went back to do they did a farewell concert, but which actually turned into the first record I did with them. We recorded that while I was there with that, but I wrote the project and then they had me come back again. And, I love playing in big bands, but I guess it's, for me, it's more fun to write for them and stand out and maybe play a couple solos, but that's like a really pretty incredible thrill to write music and heard it played back by a band of that caliber,
So you're saying it's kind of hard right now to write even with the time off because I imagine family things. Is there an ideal place for you to be able to write?
For me to write, mean place in my house?
No, as far as like
mental space.
Do you prefer being on the road?
No, I don't write well on the road. I write mostly at home. Yeah. Yeah, I'll sit at the piano and just kind of brainstorm for a while. But lately I feel like at least the last couple of tunes that I wrote just kind of came to me really quickly, which is I usually ponder over tunes for a very long time. Like I stop and I kind of memorize compositions, memorize it before I put it down on paper, Mm-hmm. No, just now it's just more of a time constraints, with kids are home all day and. I want to practice, but then I want to write. But I started something recently. I want to get back to it, and then I'm going to try to record it here at home, see how it comes out.
When did you start writing? Did it happen organically, or was there a moment where you studied with someone? How did that happen for you?
Well, I think part of working on improvisation and jazz and learning stuff is you have to learn so much harmony, I think. So I think it's kind of most jazz musicians I know write something, might just be tunes, read sheets, tunes, but I think that's kind of the nature of what we do, But I guess my first thing I ever remember writing was at Interlock in senior year of high school and playing it. I remember playing it in the chapel there. I guess I started, maybe slowly writing more. I remember at William Patterson, I was, writing some tunes, and at the time I was really into this Paul Motion trio with Joe Lovano and Bill Frisell. So I wrote a few tunes and did that at William Patterson, and even made a recording there, just messing around with it. I wonder if I still have it somewhere, but yeah, we went in just to mess around. They had a class that they let us record for the class, and then I was writing there, and then over the years, kind of starting to write more and more, and it's kind of happened, I guess, mm-hmm. Sit at the piano.
There's something nice about like creating something is a structure that'll just be there forever, besides like we play a performance and it comes and goes. I mean,
yeah, sure. Yeah.
Recording, but
yeah, I guess I just started writing more and more and, I guess studied, obviously took like arranging classes in school and stuff. I think a lot of my writing or at least my arrangements and orchestration comes more from trial and error or from sitting in a group and just listening to what's around you, and kind of trying to figure things out that way, but definitely trial and error too. Sometimes I write something now even, and I'm like, oh, that doesn't really work. That's too low on the flute part, or that doesn't come out, I just kind of started doing it there and just kind of started doing more and more of it, but like I said, I think there's a general harmonic curiosity amongst jazz musicians. Sure. And that, I think, that's kind of where most people start writing from, That said, some of the things I've written lately, I would say are more. I wrote something for the Aries Quartet.
Oh wow,
that's on their thing, yeah, and that's which is pretty. It's almost like the beginning is almost kind of fanfare-ish kind of thing. And some of the things I wrote for the Slide Monsters, they have improvisation in, but I would say they're more, kind of lyrical, classical-ish kind of things, Yeah.
So you left Germany, you come back, and let's kind of get to modern day. Like, What did you do when you came back? Was it hard to kind of break back into the scene?
Well, when I was in Germany, I was, I you know, like, for instance, I played in the Maria Schneider Orchestra, and I never stopped playing with her. So, like, I would, you know, I obviously missed some gigs that I couldn't make, but, and also there was a trio I used to play with Edmar Castaneda. I still played with him quite a bit whenever he came to Europe.
Yeah, that stuff you guys did is fantastic.
Yeah. So when he would come to Europe, I would just, you know, I'd actually, it was nice. I'd get to play the gig without jet lag, you know? but yeah, I kept on playing with Maria. And so I still play with her. We just recorded a new record. I guess when I came back, maybe I wasn't as busy at the beginning of it, but I guess when I came back, maybe I also knew I didn't want to really jump back right into doing exactly what I did before I left, you know, either. So, yeah. You know, I still, in Germany, I would still come back sometimes and do, you know, guest things at universities and things like that as well. But yeah,
you kind of had a foot in the door already. I mean, you never left. You never took the foot out of the door.
Yeah, I guess somewhat. Yeah. I mean, definitely, you know, some of the, you know, certain things I did, like I mentioned, you know, like, I don't know, certain kind of what I would call more working trombone stuff. Maybe that stuff, you know, other people were doing, but maybe also I think I kind of didn't want to, at least for the time being, didn't want to jump right back into that, you know? Yeah. And then I actually, the second year back, I guess, is when I started teaching up at Berkeley. So I started teaching up there as well. So that, you know, that was, you know, kind of things just kept on since I've been back. Actually, leading up to now, these were going to be like maybe the busiest couple months ever in my life. So
kind of crazy, huh?
Yeah, but on the other hand, I was a little nervous about it because my, you know, I'm two little kids at home. And I wanted to be gone so
right.
much, you know.
Right.
So I'm trying to look at the positive side of everything.
Yeah, there's a silver lining.
Sure. Yeah.
Was there a point? Have you kind of always had a confidence about yourself, or was there kind of a turning point in your career where you're like, at least to yourself, where you're like, okay, I can really do this. I really belong. I'm doing some special things here. Was it, you know, the Grammy nominations? I assume well before that, or did you kind of just focus on the work?
I mean, I still don't think that way. I mean, thank you for saying that, but I don't really think that way. And I think most people, I don't know, I've always kind of thought that if people do start thinking that way, there's probably I think that's kind of a problem. I don't know.
Agreed.
You know, I don't know, just do what I do because I like it. You know, I don't know. It's not a matter of, you know, I don't know. Maybe I could get better gigs if I thought that way more. I don't know. but
well, there's a fine line, right? Because it's like musicians, we're constantly self-criticizing ourselves. And it's always the balance of believing in yourself enough to be able to do these things, to give yourself confidence when you're in these, you know, pressure-filled right. situations, but also not, like you're saying, not getting too inflated where you still are humble enough to improve and work on the things you need to work on.
Well, man, I mean, now, you know, like I teach at Manhattan School of Music now, just that's, I left Berkeley earlier this year, but now I, you know, I teach a few students through Manhattan School of Music. And, you know, during this whole crisis, you know, like I still teach, you know, via Zoom. I'm sure you guys are as well, right?
It's our favorite.
Yeah. But actually, I enjoy it. We actually, you know, what we end up doing, we play tunes, you know, over, but obviously you can't play at the same time, but we'll trade choruses over, you know, over whatever tune the student's working on and stuff like that. But I still learn, you know, like I remember last week, this student I have, Greg DeAngelis, we were playing, and he, on what is this thing called Love? He played this thing. And I said, well, what is that, man? Well, what was that? You know, like, and I'm constantly, you know, I'm just constantly learning. And he was playing, we were talking about like melodic minor arpeggios out of the melodic minor scale and improvising with him. And it was this chord. And he played like that major 7 sharp 5 arpeggio out of, which comes from like the melodic minor mode, like Locrian sharp 2 scale. But he did that. And then went straight to like the same triad starting on E over the C. Anyway, I was just like, man, what is, you know, what exactly, what the way he did it though was really, really cool. So, you know, even a couple of weeks ago, I had a transcription that one of my students did that I was practicing too. And I don't know, I just feel like too many things I want to learn. And I don't know, I guess I don't really, you know, obviously, you know, sometimes you, like, if you, recognition feels good and everything, but I don't think I'll ever feel like, oh yeah. You know, I still feel like I have so many holes in my playing that I want to work on and things I want to be able to do, you know. Like today I was working on with a student, but I needed to do it too, trying to play soft. Maybe you could help me, Nick. like
what makes you think I can do it?
No, soft on like trigger, like E flats and stuff, getting that note to soft but not stuffy, and you know.
Ooh, yeah. Talking about that. That's tricky, man. I'll send you a bill.
Yeah.
You also had a big appointment this year, or I don't know if you want to call an appointment, to Vanguard Band.
Oh yeah, yeah. Sorry, I was
yeah.
I was like, wait, what? Did I miss something?
Yeah, and here we were thinking you're humble. Gigs. It's hard to track. Yeah. So what's that experience like? I mean, with such like a storied institution like that.
Man, that's, you know, that's awesome. You know, I miss it. I was thinking about today, like I was kind of like just brainstorming, kind of like daydreaming, like, man, what's the first band, what's the first gig back going to feel like? If, you know, I was thinking that could be it because it's Monday nights, you know, like I was just kind of thinking like, what's, man, like after all this is all over, what it's going to be like. But no, man, that band, it's awesome to play in that band. Also awesome to play in that club. But I first subbed in that band, I don't know, 15 years ago or something like that. I remember Luis Bonilla calling me to sub. And then, yeah, last year they started asking me to come down and sub. And then because they had a couple of vacancies. And it's actually a hike from where I live now. I live in the Hudson Valley, so.
Beautiful area.
Yeah, yeah. But yeah, it's just, man, to play that music. And also, you know, also what I love too, I mean, I love playing, I get to play all the classic Thad Jones stuff, but then they're also still always, you know, commissioning like Jim McNeely to write new. So he's writing, you know, he just wrote a whole bunch of new music for the band. And just the book, you know, it's like, you know, I don't know, a few hundred charts in it, you know? So, right. But you know, also just the feeling that when you walk down those stairs into that club, you know, it's, just knowing the history, you know, how many records you've listened to that were recorded there, you know, there's just, I don't know. I like that. I love that feeling on a, you know, on a Monday night, just to walk into there. And, but it's also fun too, you know, I love playing lead trombone, and maybe because of the timing of when I joined a lot of bands, I ended up on the part that I like playing their parts as well, but I really love, especially playing that music, though, playing like Thad and stuff. And, you know, it's a great band. I love, you know, just to play those charts and get to play lead on them. It's just, yeah, it's a lot of fun.
Yeah, that's pretty awesome. So did you get that gig? You got it sometime this year, right? Or was it maybe the end of last year?
Maybe it was the end of last year. Yeah.
So you said the book's like, you know, 100 charts thick. So I imagine more, a lot of
more
gigs.
Than that, yeah.
Yeah, more than that. So I imagine a lot of gigs you're showing up and sitting down and reading.
Well, you know, they call a lot of, I guess some of the class, especially the classic Thad Jones stuff, they call a lot of the same ones. And I guess if we're getting ready for recording, you know, they do that, but then we rehearse sometimes. So sometimes we'll run something on rehearsal, but yeah, no, primarily, I guess, you know, sometimes you're just reading, sometimes they'll call something you haven't ever played before. I'm like, oh, what's this? And sometimes it's the original chart and it looks like somebody took a bite out of the corner and you have to guess what your note is, you know?
I wanted to ask you another question, non sequitur again. I'm the king of the non sequiturs. We've asked our other guests this. What is one thing, because you're an educator yourself, what is one thing or maybe a small series of things that you find students do not do that they need to do more of?
Mm. Well, they should turn off their phones when they practice.
Interesting.
I should.
That's where the metronome is. What do you mean?
Yeah, they should buy an analog, they should buy an external tuner.
I could not agree more.
I mean,
record on wax wheel, maybe.
Yeah. I mean, I think fundamental stuff, you know, paying, this is kind of technical stuff, but paying attention, really spending time with a tuner and learning where the positions really are. You know what I mean?
Learning
where's your F above, you know, middle B flat, you know, where is that? You know, is that, you know, how far out is it? You know, where is it? If you're going to play high C in first position, how far out do you have to come? You know, your lower register, you know, it's every horn's different, but just learning where the overtones are on your horn. I think that people really need to spend a lot of time doing that.
So you didn't get the tuning at the factory?
No. Maybe next time. Yeah.
In the festival we run that's connected with this podcast, the There Goes Trombone Tree, we talk a lot about relationships. And, you know, just hearing you tell your story, it seems like everywhere you went, there was someone giving you an opportunity, giving you a chance, helping you, influencing you in some way. Can you talk about the importance in the profession of music, especially in your world, of just relationships and how you build those and how you treat people?
I kind of always, when people ask me that kind of question, I kind of always just say this, like, man, be the best possible player you can be who's not a jerk, you know?
I like it.
You know, like that, I don't know. I mean, I don't think it's, you know, like, you know, especially nowadays with social media and stuff, people sometimes, hey, man, so what was your business plan when you came out of school? And I was just like, business plan? Like, what are you talking about? Like, just practice. That was like my business plan, you know? It still is, you know? Yeah, I mean, yeah, I think respect people, you know, like give it up for people when they help you, you know, like I try to mention, you know, if I'm in a masterclass and or if I, in my routine, thinking about this today, but if I talk about it, somebody like, oh, man, I got this exercise from so-and-so, give this, you know, I guess just don't ever undercut somebody to get further. I don't know. I don't know if that's, is that the right word?
No, I get what you're saying.
I don't know. I've always felt that way. Just like, man, you know, like be the best possible player you can be and be respectful to the people you're around and you'll be fine, you know? I think that's, I don't know, to me, but I don't know. What's your experience like?
Well, I think you're kind of nailing it. And I think it's surprising how many people can't master that second part of it, of just the respect part. I think, you know, gratitude is free, you know, to always be thankful, treat people like people instead of like, I want something from this person.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of those three rules, that famous graduation speech about what you just said made me think of it. That famous writer, and I'm forgetting his name right now, he wrote Coraline. I'm sure everyone remembers now, but he said to be successful in any profession, you have to have three things. There's three traits of being successful in a profession, and you only have to have two of them. It's be really good at what you do, be a really nice person, and always turn your work in on time, mm-hmm. or always be on time. And so you can be like, you can be really good at what you do, always on time, and kind of be a dick and get away with it. You know, it, of course, it's better to have all three.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I've heard it put that you need to, but to thrive, you need mm-hmm. all three, you know?
Yeah, yeah. I think I, you know, I've definitely gotten more punctual over the years. Yeah, I'm usually pretty early for things now, generally, you know?
Yeah. Well, in jazz, you're not supposed to be on time, right?
Yeah, right, right, yeah. Let's be a little late. Actually, the last ITF I played, the jazz concert was the only one that ran on time.
Really?
Yeah, all the other ones went like an hour and a half too long, you know. And like
yeah. And another thing I wanted to ask you is, do you have any crazy gig stories you want to share? Because you seem, I mean, you've had such a variety of gigs, you know, from cruise ships to playing salsa bands, to playing big bands, to writing charts, all sorts of stuff. I'd be curious if there's anything that stuck out.
Man, let's see. Crazy gig stories. I could tell a couple. The first one's not that's crazy, but I went with Edmar one time. We went to play, I think it was in Toulouse Jazz Festival or Toulouse World Music Festival or something like that. You know what intermiton is in France? It's this system. I'm probably saying, I'm sorry if there's any French speakers that are listening. I probably just butchered the word, but.
We have a huge French audience.
Oh, yeah. Cool. Yeah. Seven. Yeah, we flew to Toulouse to play this festival, and then intermiton is like intermittence, I guess. So like the government, like if you do a certain number of gigs in 1 year, I'm not explaining it correctly, but basically you qualify for even the next year. If you don't do the same number of gigs, you're still going to get paid the same amount, you know.
Right. Yeah.
So anyway, there was a
I know what you're talking about.
They were trying to change something in the system, so there were these protests. And so for our concert, these three trio that flew over from New York that has nothing to do with the system, but they basically did a sit-in on our stage where we were supposed to play and protest. So we never played the gig. We flew all the way to
Toulouse.
They protested. It had nothing to do with us, but they just happened to choose that time in our festival. So we still got paid.
Did they pay you?
Got paid.
Oh, good.
And then they had us back the next year, and we finally played the concert and got paid again. So it was, you know, but that was an interesting one. Salsa gigs. There was one, that place I was telling you, 181st, the Shell Station on 181 in Amsterdam.
Oh, yeah.
I know how that is.
Well.
I live up in the Heights, and Sebastian used to live in the Heights. So.
Oh, okay. Yeah, yeah.
I know that Shell Station.
So I went to meet the bus, that same band I was talking about, Raulín Rosendo. And, man, I was waiting for like 3 hours. And finally, finally the bus came, but we were still waiting for the piano player, you know, and the piano player is still not there. So I'm like, oh man. So I said to the singer, he's sitting right there, my horn's there on the bus. I said, man, I'm going to run to the deli. Do you want anything? He's like, oh yeah, buy me some Cheetos or whatever, you know? And so I, you know, waiting for 3 hours, I walk for 2 minutes across the street to the bodega to buy some snacks for the bus, including his Cheetos, and my horn's on the bus. And I walk back across the street. There goes the bus onto the Cross Bronx. And I'm like, the piano player showed up in the 1 minute I went to buy some Cheetos, you know? And so, the manager had called the book was originally for 4 trombones in that, but we had been playing with 3 because I guess he wanted to save some money. But he called another guy that day too, so we were gonna have the full book. And so I immediately thought like, oh man, he just doesn't want to pay me or something like that. So I told the bus driver to leave. I didn't know what I was freaking out. And this is before I didn't have a cell phone yet. This is like before cell phones were just, you know, everybody had one or whatever. So, but I had this friend of mine, or this other salsa singer that I played with. I was like 21 years old, and I was just like, oh man, my horn's gone, you know. But I, back then when I first, I had a phone at home, and I had like my first address book, I guess you could have. I had a piece of construction paper above my phone where I just wrote people's phone numbers down, and I had the numbers memorized. And so I knew this guy Blasini's number, Luis Blasini, who that was a great band we used to play. He had all these old Eddie Palmieri charts and stuff. And, but anyway, I called him up. I said, Blasini, man, this is what just happened. What do I do? He goes, he said, Marshall. He's like, man, I'm going to call my buddy Johnny. We're going to come down. When they come back, we're going to kick their ass. And I was like, well, no, let me, he's like, you know, if you don't, let me know if you don't get it. Cause I, you know, and I was like, okay, well, okay. So
they had your back.
Yeah. And so then my buddy, Mark Miller, I don't know if you guys know him, trombone player, a good friend of mine, but we used to play, you know, gigs back then. And I had his number memorized. And I remember he lived up there somewhere. So I called him. I said, man, Mark, this happened. And he was like, oh man, well just come over to my house and hang out. And then, I don't know, we'll just walk back there in a few hours and just wait because they have to come back at some point. So we did. And I'm just thinking like, man, this is, you know, am I going to get my horn back? What's going on? And the bus shows up, the manager gets up the bus and runs over. And I remember I had already started saying, man, I just want to get my horn, you know, I just want my horn back. And the manager's like, man, I'm so sorry. The bus driver was out of his mind. Wouldn't stop, wouldn't turn around. And he handed me the cash for the gig was the first thing. And I was like, well,
nice.
I said, what? Oh, well, it was a little short, but I was like, yeah, I'm not going to complain. I didn't have to ride the bus all night, but it was just like, it's like, I remember those couple hours. I just thought like, man, how am I going to get another trombone right now? You know,
man.
So, the good thing about the Heights is there's always a trombonist within like 2 blocks of every place you are.
But yeah, I don't know. I'm sure there's some other crazy stories. I just can't really remember right now, but.
I think that we've got a good slice of Marshall, and it's really cool to hear your story. Pretty amazing what you've packed into, relatively short amount of time.
Oh, thanks, man.
It's relatively for all of us, right?
Yeah.
But it's amazing. I mean, yeah, you've literally done what you can do on the trombone on land and sea.
Yeah. I hope we all get back to something. Well, actually, I hope it's not exactly where we were before. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah.
So well, like what would be different? What would be different?
I don't know exactly, but I think in general though, like, maybe not as much in the classical world, but I don't know. You just see like audiences, just everybody's on their phone, you know, people pretending like they focus for 10 minutes. And I don't know, maybe we'll all value the good things in life a little more after this is all finished. I don't know.
But yeah, I hope we don't have a bad case of revertigo as a society going back into our shitty old ways.
Yeah, I hope not either. You know, I don't know.
I have a feeling it'll be a mixture of both.
Yeah,
maybe.
I do too.
You know, personal decision. Yeah. I mean, I've definitely come to a lot of realizations during this time. And even just turning your phone off for a few hours is like, I get so much done. I get so much creativity done. It's just...
That's true, man. We go for walks with my kids and stuff. I try to leave my phone at home so I can't look. Just can't.
Yeah.
I've been bad.
It's so knee jerk.
Yeah. I've been bad lately the last few days. Just
that dopamine hits of notifications.
Yeah, right. Not in my, I have like a kind of studio set up down here in my basement where I'm at now.
This is where the online trombone lessons are. We didn't even talk about that. Okay,
yeah. You can if you want still. Right?
That one with your son where he plays the drums. Yeah. I know it was like funny, but he's like, he's really listening.
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah.
Like really matching what you're doing is really, really nice.
Yeah, I don't know why I started doing that.
It's awesome, man.
That's great.
Yeah.
It's what the trombone world needs is a little less seriousness about mouthpieces and slide oil.
Yeah, that was. I guess that's what kind of led me to it. It's like the every time you go on Facebook, you see a new person giving like a long tone lesson or something. No,
so. Especially now.
I did a lot of deep dive Marshall Jilks studying the last couple of days, and it's definitely I definitely had some battles with Alexa.
Oh yeah,
you have to say Gilks for everything.
Oh okay.
Is that how Alexa pronounces your name? You should contact, is it Google or Amazon?
Amazon. Oh,
tell them, yeah. Hey, man, I bought $400 worth of diapers from you. The least you can do is pronounce my name correctly.
Exactly.
Do you know who I am?
Yes, I will hold.
Excuse me, can you transfer me to Jeff Bezos, please?
Yeah.
This is Marshall.
You'll know.
What's up, Gilks? No.
Yeah, that's why I'm calling.
Wow. Marshall, thanks so much for hanging out with us today. We really enjoyed it and really enjoyed hearing about your life.
Man, thanks for having me. It was a lot of fun. And hope we can do it again sometime.
Absolutely. Yeah, maybe in person.
Yeah, that'd be
absolutely
crazy. Huh?
So 2022 is going to be an awesome
year. Yeah, it is.
All right. Thanks, Marshall.
All right. Thank you, Marshall. Well, I think that was a lovely talk with Marshall Jilks, not Gilks. But yeah, I think it was a great talk with him. Great to hear what's going on in his life and what he's doing to pass time in the pandemic era. It's always good to hear that someone so amazing is so down to earth.
Yeah, I think he's a very relatable guy. I mean, at the end of the day, that's what you realize. The more really great players you play next to, I mean, everyone's just trying to do their best and challenging themselves and trying to be the best versions of themselves. And, you know, it's fascinating to talk to really talented people and just seeing what their traits are. But he seems like someone that's always enjoyed the work, enjoyed the craft, never kind of put himself in boxes as far as what type of trombonist he is or what style he can or can't do, because he pretty much can do everything. I mean, you've played with him. Was it at the Philharmonic?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So he subs there, and we didn't talk about it in the podcast, but I mean, when they had, was it the assistant principal trombone opening at the New York Philharmonic? He took that audition and he advanced, I believe.
Yeah, I think that's true. I cannot confirm it, but I've heard that is true. We should have asked him. He would have been able to ask.
I know. We only talked to him for an hour and a half, I guess. Didn't have enough time to squeeze it in.
Yeah.
Hey, Nick, we have a question, though.
Oh, a question.
Okay, so this question comes from Wilfred the Ding Dong Ditcher.
Mm-hmm.
That's an unfortunate name for the birth certificate. Mr. Shorts, like S-H-O-R-T-S.
That's definitely correct.
Okay. Mr. Shorts is one handsome dude. His ingenious sense of humor complements Sebastian's ASMR level commentary perfectly. Yes, siree. Yes, siree. This podcast sure makes you feel warm and fuzzy on the inside. Quick quest. What fundamental issue on the trombone did you struggle with most, and what discovery led you to put that issue in its place? Sending healthy vibes your way. Oh, thank you very much.
Well, first of all, before I answer the question, do you think we should blow this person's cover? Because through my amazing sleuthing, I was able to discover who this was. Should we blow his cover?
Knowing this person, I think we definitely should.
Well, then I'm going to speak directly to Timothy J. Maines.
I know Tim really hates it. He really hates attention. You know,
he really hates it. I call him Shark Eyes because he's got the eyes and the mannerisms of a shark. And take that however you want to take it. But all right, I'm going to answer you because you did, within all of your yuck-yucking around, ask a serious question.
Yeah.
Okay, so fundamental problems. I would say the biggest thing I struggled with was consistency, and specifically consistency of articulation, and specifically within that articulation within the mid-range, kind of on the B-flat partial, the tuning B-flat partial. I would always get these little burrs on the front of notes, and it was something that I just had to, explore a lot with and kind of throw out the rule book as far as like, this is how you articulate. Cause obviously what I thought about articulation wasn't working in this range for some reason. It was causing this brr, brr on the front of the notes. So I had to rediscover a lot of things, and that just took a lot of exploration. Got a lot of messing around.
What was the sound it was making? Brr, brr. Oh, wow. Like a bird call.
Yeah. People do call me the songbird of my generation. I think that's why. But I would say, yeah, just the biggest thing, and I teach a lot of this, no matter what the problem is in my studio, if you will, is to do a lot of creative exploration in your playing. Assume nothing and be open-minded to solutions. So that means, like I said, throwing out the rule book and trying to discover new ways to do things that actually work. And in the end, if it sounds right, it is right. So when it started sounding better, even though the articulations felt strange, they sounded good. So I was like, okay, that must work. And so I started building up this kind of new way to articulate that was a little bit more consistent and clean, and it worked. So that's kind of how I worked through it. But I think that this sort of mentality applies to all sorts of problems in playing, not just articulation. Being open-minded and exploratory. What about you, Seb?
I echo a lot of those same sentiments, and I definitely want to talk about that. I would say a weakness I felt like I had for a long time going through college was kind of the low trigger range. And like with a lot of things, and this was a broader realization, I wasn't spending enough time doing it. You know, we don't, the average person doesn't, especially younger players I've noticed, don't want to spend a lot of time sounding bad, because who wants to sound bad? People that are most successful embrace those things, attack those weaknesses. You know, I played for Dave Taylor in a masterclass once in grad school, and he just got me on doing glisses every day from first position down in every partial, slow glisses, finding the center of it and crescendoing as I do it. And I just did that every day. And I'm a big believer in whatever we focus the most on, we can make a strength. So a lot of people and a lot of traits of my playing, stuff that was previously a weakness, because I devoted so much attention to it, became a strength, became a source of confidence. And that only has to happen once for you to realize how infectious that can be about all aspects of your playing. So I think it's so important to not take things personally and just enjoy, like, oh, I kind of suck at this. Oh, I'm going to work on this. You know, it's about putting the time in. Every single player has certain things they're really good at, certain things they had to work for. People were just like handed a trombone and just everything worked. You know, so I think it's, well, besides you, Nick.
Of course. Yeah. I wanted to say something else. What was that?
I know. I blew your mind for a minute.
You did. Kinda,
you had to take a second. I get it.
You did blow my mind. Yeah. Oh, this is what I want to say. So, you know, it was a couple of years ago at the trombone retreat that I was teaching like a string of 10 or trombone lessons in a row, like, I don't know, 3 or 4 in a day. And just coincidentally, all of them came in and I said, okay, what do you want to work on? Like, that's how I start pretty much every lesson. What do you want to work on today? And they all said, yeah, I want to work on my low range. And, you know, I figured, okay, they want to work on low range with a bass trombone player. And so they come in and, you know, they're having problems with the low range. So good. We're going to work on something that's your problem. And so I say, okay, what are you doing to make this better? How are you working on it? Well, I don't know. I was hoping you'd give me some insight. And okay, I will. But like, what are you doing right now? Well, I'm playing Bordoni down an octave. Okay. How often are you playing your Bordonis down an octave? Maybe like once a day. Okay, how long does it take you? I'll run it through. It'll be like 5 minutes. So we broke down. It's like, okay, they can come in. They want to work on their low range. And they haven't worked on they're not really working on their low range. And by the end of the lesson, they're sounding pretty good in the low range because they've spent 30, 40 minutes going back and forth with me playing this stuff in the low range. And it wasn't any magical pill that I had that I was able to sell them. It's like, hey, you did this consistently for 30 minutes and suddenly it sounded better. You just need to do that every day. And so that was kind of the end of those lessons was, hey, you already had the solution. You were just a little bit too lazy to actually do it.
Yeah, I think more and more as we evolve as a culture, I mean, we're getting with, let me say it like this. The more technology advances, the more quickly we're used to things working. You know, you can download an app for almost everything. When you play the trombone, this is old school. This is old school, you know, master apprentice, slow progress over time work. So you have to build these pathways in your brain. You have to put in time to improve. So getting frustrated when you can't play something after a week is wasting your time. You got to be patient with yourself. Nick and I have had this conversation a million times with young people. I'm sure anyone that's ever taught young players has had this conversation. One of the biggest things young people want to be better at is high range. I just don't feel like I have a good high range. My high range isn't good. And it's always the same question that we ask back. It's like, well, how often do you play high?
Yeah.
just like what you're talking about with low range. And it's usually not enough. It's not just this, once you get it, once you understand in your mind, yes, that's part of it, understanding certain correct technical things to do. But so much of our work is just putting the time in, training a muscle. You know, we're athletes of small muscles. And sometimes you just need to get stronger.
Well, yeah, and it's like going back to the low range thing. It's like maybe there's a player who's out there, a tenor trombone player, and they are putting in the time playing down there in the low range. And then they'll come to me with something like Mahler 5 would be a good example. Ba-ba-be-bom, ba-ba-be-bom, the second trombone part. And they can't articulate cleanly, but they can play down there. They play, you know, maybe some scales down there real slow. But I'm like, okay, how often do you articulate stuff down there? It's like, oh, I do my Bordoni. It's like, well, it's totally different. So you're mad at yourself for not being able to do it, but you've never actually trained yourself to do it. You've never put in the time playing articulate and low. And the same thing goes for organ symphony, playing soft and low, or playing, I don't know, Berg three pieces. It's like, well,
wait, are you saying Bordonis don't directly apply to Mahler 5?
You know, I like crushing a B down as hard as anyone else, but you know, Mahler wasn't about that B-down life.
It took me a second to realize what you meant by B-down, and then it clicked, and I didn't, and then I had to think about what I thought about that.
Shark Eyes, I hope that answers your question.
Yeah, and we love these questions and keep sending them in. We'll try to get to all of them eventually. But yeah, just leave a 5-star review, write down a comment and question. We're happy to talk about it on the end of the podcast. So remember to subscribe to the podcast. Follow us at Trombone Retreat on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube. And once again,
retreat yourself.
Retreat yourself.